This is part two of the lecture, Capitalism versus Anti-Capitalism, Reason versus Muscle Mysticism. The substance of capitalism in practice is selfishness and the use of reason. Its ultimate philosophical base is a morality of selfishness and an epistemology of reason, which means, in one word, objectivism. The hostility to capitalism proceeds from the antitheses of selfishness and reason, namely from altruism and mysticism, both of which, since Kant, have overwhelmed philosophy, the arts, and the humanities in the broader sense, that is, economics, political science, history, and psychology, and have even seriously undermined the foundations of mathematics and the natural sciences. The growth of mysticism in our culture is what accounts for the fact that mankind has been retreating for the last century at an ever-accelerating pace away from capitalism and back to a social system that is fundamentally indistinguishable from that of the Middle Ages, socialism. The arguments against capitalism are rarely the product of simple error. Almost always there is a major element of irrationalism involved, either nakedly smirking or hidden not too far below the surface. The economic theories of Lord Keynes are an obvious example of bald-faced irrationalism. I quote from his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, quote, "Pyramid building, earthquakes, even wars may serve to increase wealth if the education of our statesmen on the principles of the classical economics stands in the way of anything better," end quote. And he goes on, quote, "If the Treasury were to fill old bottles with banknotes, bury them at suitable depths in disused coal mines, which are then filled up to the surface with town rubbish, and leave it to private enterprise, on well-tried principles of laissez-faire, to dig the notes up again, the right to do so being obtained, of course, by tendering for leases of the note-bearing territory, there need be no more unemployment, and with the help of the repercussions, the real income of the community, and its capital wealth also, would probably become a good deal greater than it actually is. It would, indeed, be more sensible to build houses and the like, but if there are political and practical difficulties in the way of this, the above would be better than nothing." End quote. And then, in the final paragraph of the same chapter, The Marginal Propensity to Consume, Keynes concludes, quote, "Ancient Egypt was doubly fortunate, and doubtless owed to this its fabled wealth, in that it possessed two activities, namely pyramid building as well as the search for the precious metals, the fruits of which, since they could not serve the needs of man by being consumed, did not stale with abundance. The Middle Ages built cathedrals and sang dirges. Two pyramids, two masses for the dead, are twice as good as one, but not so two railways from London to York. Thus, we are so sensible, have schooled ourselves to so close a semblance of prudent financiers, taking careful thought before we add to the financial burdens of posterity, by building them houses to live in, that we have no such easy way to escape from the sufferings of unemployment. We have to accept them as an inevitable result of applying to the conduct of the state the maxims which are best calculated to enrich an individual, by enabling him to pile up claims to enjoyment which he does not intend to exercise at any definite time." End quote. If Keynes had been a jungle savage, familiar with no greater wealth than a few trinkets and a mud hut, it would have been understandable why he should have been impressed with the, quote, fabled wealth of ancient Egypt. But his epistemology was beneath that of a savage. It enabled him to blank out the fact that he lived in a country which had railway lines, and had them because the wealth of its people had not been taxed or otherwise expropriated to pay for pyramids, cathedrals, the singing of dirges, or for more modern monuments of altruism, such as TVA, but was left free to be saved. This is no place to attempt a critique of Keynes' technical economic theories. That is a full semester's work. It was especially in regard to his doctrines that I recommended at the start of my talk that you steep yourselves in the writings of the old British classical economists. There you will find the answers, or the leads to the answers, to all of the seeming paradoxes concerning wealth, those presented by Keynes and those presented by all of the other supporters of the idea that depressions are caused by too little consumption or by too much production. I will only note here that under consumptionism and overproductionism, in all their varieties, Keynesian and otherwise, are arguments which claim that reason is man's tool of destruction. Depressions and poverty, they claim, are the result of the exercise of his rationality in the saving of money, and his rationality in the invention of new machines. As to the causes of depressions, time allows me to say no more than that they are the result of government intervention, and of precisely the kind advocated by Keynes. No depression could ever occur without a major decrease in the quantity of money. But there never could be a major decrease in the quantity of money if there had not first been a major issue of paper money, currency or checking deposits, that was not covered by gold or silver reserves. A money that consisted only of gold and silver coins and of paper 100% backed by gold or silver could virtually never be decreased in quantity. The only possible source of reductions in its quantity would be from such things as the sinking of ships and the filling of teeth, which would almost certainly always be more than compensated by the mining of fresh gold and silver. Were it not for the activities of governments, however, there could never be a major issue of paper money not covered by gold or silver reserves. Government, therefore, in issuing and encouraging the issue of paper money in excess of gold and silver reserves, creates the conditions without which the existence of depressions would be an impossibility. It is responsible for the stage being set for the major contractions in the quantity of money, without which depressions could not occur. Many of the other arguments against capitalism, or in favor of government intervention, are nothing more than an open confession of self-made mental incompetence, of irrationalism in the way one functions in one's life, which is then flaunted as an accusation against capitalism and arrogantly asserted as grounds for an unquestioned right to help. These arguments against capitalism may be said to consist in nothing but the assertion of a divine right of mindlessness. Let us consider some of the issues in this category. People demand a Social Security program and Medicare. On what grounds? They claim they cannot save for their own old age or buy a medical insurance policy because they are too weak-minded. Currently, a clamor is being made on behalf of the so-called Truth in Lending and Truth in Packaging bills. What is the argument? People openly declare that they are unable to compare interest rates quoted on the basis of different lengths of time, or to determine such things as which costs more per serving, a box containing 8 servings of instant mashed potatoes for 34 cents, or another box containing 10 servings of instant mashed potatoes for 46 cents. Legislation covering the securities markets and the legislation behind the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation proceed from the demand that people be able to invest their money safely without having to take the trouble to know what they are doing, without having to learn how to read balance sheet and income statements, to know how to weigh and judge facts, and how to distinguish facts from mere assertions. Advertising is denounced with absolutely no sign of shame on the grounds that one is so weak-minded that merely hearing or seeing a sponsor's message compels one, like a robot in which the right button has been pressed, to go and buy his product, whether one needs it or not, wants it or not, can afford it or not, and even if one is absolutely convinced that it is harmful. Food and drug laws are supported, unblushingly, on the grounds that differentiating between food that is good and food that is tainted, or between healthful drugs and poisons, would take too much trouble. One would have to be aware, one would have to know something, one would have to decide whom to trust. Instead of let the buyer be aware, the philosophy of these laws is let the buyer be unaware, let him live in a fog. Industrial safety laws that force businesses to take precautions beyond the level logically dictated by their own weighing of risks and expenses, including the higher wages they have to pay to attract workers to dangerous jobs, are openly supported in the fear that without them, one would be stumbling into exposed blades, knocking into live wires, backing into whirling rotors, or walking into grinding machinery. In a word, in the fear that one will be out of focus even when one knows one's very life and limb are at stake. Such laws are an attempt to escape the logically necessary nature of one's physical environment, which cannot avoid holding the potential for danger. By means of threatening men with a presumably non-dangerous gun, a gun held in the hands of those who declare themselves untrustworthy to use a shears or a lathe, or held in the hands of government officials chosen by them. Even the opposition to such a thing as free competition in municipal bus service reflects irrationalism of a personal day-to-day variety. It is sometimes argued, for example, that if competing bus lines existed, a rider might be confused between, let us say, a number 4 Smith bus, which took the route he wanted to follow, and a number 4 Jones bus, which later turned off and took a different route. Free competition should be prohibited, it is held, in order to spare such a rider the necessity of distinguishing between the similar buses of the different companies. Irrationalism in the way one functions in one's daily life spawns and then feeds an opposition to capitalism which can only be described as psychotic. One blames and accepts doctrines which blame the disappointment of one's every last random whim on the diabolical machinations of beings who in an earlier age would have been called devils. Time and again, the man who does not get the raise he wanted, or the housewife who must pay a few pennies more for some good she buys, knows only that he or she wanted something and cannot have it. With no care or concern for why one didn't get the raise or why one must pay more, one places the blame on the allegedly arbitrary power of one's employer or grocer. Their alleged whims are made the scapegoat for the disappointment of one's own whims, and then one carries this attitude into one's appraisal of the economic system at large. Consider the things which people believe. For example, prices are rising. Why are they rising? Because, people believe, the merchants or middlemen or manufacturers are making them rise. It's their arbitrary will. If they didn't want prices to rise, they wouldn't rise. Or the rents of certain slum families are high. What is the reason? The answer is that they are high because of the arbitrary will of the landlords. If the landlords didn't want the rents to be high, they wouldn't be high. Or, to take one more example, the wage rates of Mexican farm workers in California are low. Why? Again, the answer is someone's arbitrary will. This time, the arbitrary will of the farmers. If the farmers didn't want the wage rates of their workers to be low, they wouldn't be low. There is absolutely no difference between the way masses of people view their economic environment and the way a jungle savage views his physical environment. He believes that physical phenomena are determined by the arbitrary will of beings stronger than himself. They believe that economic phenomena are determined by the arbitrary will of beings stronger than themselves. The jungle savage differentiates between good and bad gods. In the same way, they differentiate between government and business, to both of which they ascribe the power to perform miracles and to determine their fate. The jungle savage calls upon the good gods to order the bad gods to do his will. They call upon government to order business to do their will. The program and the philosophy of anti-capitalism is the mindless use of force based on the jungle savage's belief that the universe is ruled by someone's whim. Any fact which one refuses to accept, and whose cause one does not care to know, from rising prices to poor housing to misreading the directions on a can, one blames on the arbitrary will of the business gods. And then one seeks to invoke the aid of the government god, the strongest of the deities in the alleged social pantheon, to club the business gods into the satisfaction of one's whims. If prices or rents are high, the government will order them to be low. If wages are low, the government will order them to be high, and so on, in case after case. This is the philosophy which our 20th century intellectuals and politicians believe is enlightened, progressive, and humanitarian. They have no conception of any other. And when they denounce the advocates of capitalism as being reactionary, hard-hearted, and cruel, they speak from the premise that the supporters of capitalism dwell with them in the dementia they have created for themselves. To them, the issue is, they want God to raise wages, lower prices, create houses and medical care, and so on. Only the advocates of capitalism don't want God to do these things. Thus, they conclude, the advocates of capitalism must be unenlightened, just plain mean, and belong in the dinosaur age, when men didn't understand the miraculous and believed only in causality. Under the influence of Karl Marx and the other socialist authors, this kind of simple-mindedness is carried to the level of a full-blown psychosis, literally on a par with the belief that one is the victim of invisible Martians emitting death rays. Consider, what do so many people believe would happen under laissez-faire? What do they believe did happen? In their view, without minimum wage laws and the legislation that enables unions to resort to force, businessmen would be able to use their allegedly arbitrary power to drive wage rates to the minimum physical subsistence level. Without maximum hours legislation, they believe, this same evil power of the businessmen would be able to force a lengthening of the working day to 16, 18, or 20 hours, and to impose a pace of work that would leave one no time to catch one's breath or take an instant's rest. With the combination of no laws designed to protect wage rates and no child labor laws, they believe, all children above the age of 3 would be driven into the mines. To concretize this theory, what it means is that wage rates under capitalism would supposedly be set in the following way. Every morning in the Wall Street Journal, after the latest quotations from the stock and commodity exchanges, there would appear a set of price quotations for the items required by a wage earner's family to give it a minimum physical subsistence standard of living. By the logic of the theory, these items should comprise the use of a mud cabin, a quantity of potatoes and gruel, and, periodically, some new loincloths. The capitalists would then take the sum of the respective prices times quantities of the various items and use that figure as the income they would pay to a wage earner's family. In exchange for that income, they would require the family's members to expend the maximum possible amount of labor that they were capable of performing. According to Marx and his followers, however, the capitalists would not be satisfied even with this, for they would also herd their workers into company towns in order to make them pay outrageous rentals for company-owned mud cabins and outrageous prices for potatoes, gruel, and loincloths that they would then have to buy at company-owned stores. Going still further, in the absence of food and drug laws, industrial safety laws, and government building codes, the capitalists would, on this psychotic conception of things, find their pleasure and profit in activities of the following kind. The food companies would make fabulous profits by selling tainted meat, sugar adulterated with sand, and bread baked from ashes. The drug companies would grow rich by putting thalidomide in aspirin tablets. Coal producers would inflate their profits through coal mine explosions, and factory owners would expand their incomes in proportion to the number of workers killed or maimed in accidents in their plants. And, of course, construction companies would make fortunes by erecting buildings that would collapse on the heads of their tenants. All of Marxism is nothing but the excrement of minds consumed with blind, unreasoning hatred for an external scapegoat for their own emptiness. Marxism is the philosophic expression of those who are vindictive for their own irrationality, of those who, refusing to know their own self-made simple-mindedness, seek to invent a diabolical monster on whom they can shift the blame for their deserved misfortunes. Now, there is one aspect of Marxism that deserves some special consideration, because it belongs more with some other non-Marxian doctrines than with the main body of Marxist theories, and that is the Marxian doctrine on monopoly. I want to discuss the monopoly issue starting with Marx and finishing with the theory of so-called pure and perfect competition, and then conclude. The Marxian doctrine on monopoly is that capitalism is headed for the day when General Bull Moose will leap from the pages of the Little Abner comic strip to become sole owner of the world. Since the general standard of living under capitalism is already supposed to be at the minimum subsistence level without General Bull Moose, it is difficult to see why this should make any real difference. However, before that day arrives, the few alleged expropriators who yet remain will supposedly be expropriated by society, and that will represent the establishment of socialism. All of this is supposed to be inevitable and is what allegedly makes the coming of socialism inevitable. Now, any fear that there is a tendency in capitalism toward the concentration of all ownership in the hands of one man or one corporation is absurd. Such a development would contradict the very nature of the division of knowledge and the division of labor, and it would, therefore, be against the self-interests of everyone, including General Bull Moose. It can only be brought about by means of force, and once it is brought about, as in every communist country, it is only maintained by altruism on the part of the ruling group. To illustrate this point, let us assume that the Communist Party of Russia, became sufficiently disenchanted with altruism to want to employ all of the vast property which it presently controls openly in behalf of the material self-interests of its members. Let us assume that the Russian Communist Party were to become completely separated from the Russian government, much as the Roman Catholic Church became separated from the governments of France and Italy in earlier centuries. Let us assume further that it was permitted to take with it in the separation, as its own private property, all of the inhabited land of Russia, and all of the factories, farms, mines, and stores it presently possesses in its capacity as the effective government of Russia. It would retain title, we may assume, as the Catholic Church and the feudal lords retained title to the properties they had originally obtained by means of force. If this were to happen, and the members of the Communist Party wished to act on behalf of their own material self-interests, or even merely to increase the wealth of the Communist Party corporation, their first step would be to place much or even most or all of their property into the possession of others. They would sell out to them on credit. Why? Because if the members of the Communist Party consulted their own material self-interests, they would realize how far they are from being omniscient, and even how far they are from possessing the knowledge required to grow a significant quantity of turnips. By placing a major portion or even all of their property in the ownership of others, its effective employment would be so greatly increased, so much more could be produced, that the Communist Party as a private corporation would soon find itself much richer, owning 20 or 25% of a greatly expanded Russian economy than 100% of the present Russian economy. And as time wore on, its relative significance in the Russian economy would continue to decrease, though its absolute wealth might continue to increase. None of this is to advocate in the least that Russia someday be desocialized in this manner. The Communist Party and its members have no right to anything. It is merely to make the point that anyone following his self-interest knows that it is to his self-interest that there exist other people able to act without being dependent on the use of his property and thus of obtaining his consent. The idea of one man or one corporation even wanting to own everything, let alone ever being able to in a free society, is typical of the altruist mentality. It reflects its evasion of the fact that wealth must be produced and that independent thinking is necessary. It reveals once again the altruist notion that wealth is a static, nature-given quantity to be taken over and jealously guarded by the clever means of preventing its creation. Capitalism guarantees the existence of many separate independent sellers, and as a rule, more than one in each industry. It is not true that it is necessarily to a firm's self-interest to be the sole producer even within its own field of specialization, assuming that it could be if it wished to be, which most often it cannot be. Consider the following example, which is typical of a great many cases, the razor blade industry. No one in the United States abstains from shaving because the price of razor blades is too high. If the price were reduced, the quantity of additional blades that could be sold would be relatively insignificant. At the present time, Gillette is the major producer in this field. What percentage of the market it has, I do not know. But for the sake of illustration, let us assume that it presently does 80% of the razor blade business. It is quite possible that by means of low-cost manufacturing techniques that are a secret from its competitors, Gillette could sell razor blades at a lower price, which would still enable it to make money, but which would eventually drive its competitors out of business. However, there would be no advantage to Gillette in cutting its price. It is better off doing 80% of the business and making a high profit on each package of razor blades than 100% of the business and making a much lower profit on each package of razor blades. For in order to acquire what for it would represent only a 25% increase in its own volume, it would almost certainly have to reduce its profit per unit by considerably more than 25%. A mere 10% price reduction would mean a 25% reduction in profit per unit on the extremely generous assumption that 40% of Gillette's initial price is profit. If only 10% of Gillette's initial price is profit, a 10% reduction in price would virtually totally eliminate its profit. Whenever a firm already has the bulk of a market, and the market is of a kind that cannot be expanded significantly by means of price reductions, there is no reason for it to employ any advantages of lower costs it may possess for the purpose of driving its small competitors out. The added volume their business would represent would not offset the reduction in profit per unit it would have to take on its present, much larger business. Now, it is also not the case that a firm could employ the tactic of cutting its price, driving its competitors out, and then raising its price above what the price was initially. This policy would be ruinous, and it was never resorted to by the trusts or by the chain stores. For the actual history of Standard Oil's alleged predatory price cutting, I refer you to the article by John S. McGee, Predatory Price Cutting, the Standard Oil New Jersey Case, in the October 1958 issue of the Journal of Law and Economics, published by the University of Chicago Law School. The very nature of a trust is in full contradiction to driving one's competitors out by means of ruinous price cutting. The trusts, in essence, were the product of the mutually advantageous merger of many small competitors. They were established in order to make it possible for more modern, more efficient, larger scale plants to replace older, less efficient, smaller scale plants. They followed the policy of buying out or giving participation to the owners of the older, less efficient plants, and then eventually replacing those plants with a smaller number of more efficient, larger scale plants. Their price reductions were of a kind commensurate with their cost reductions and were designed both to encourage the expansion of demand and to discourage others from building new plants. They did not follow the policy of slashing prices in order later on to be able to raise them, because they would have had the most to lose from such a policy, since they were the largest suppliers and would have had to suffer such price reductions on a greater volume than anyone else. The trusts made it possible to introduce improvements in production which otherwise could not have been introduced. Their effect was greater efficiency, lower costs, higher profits for all who joined them, and even for most of those who merely sold out to them, and lower prices of a kind that were capable of and were intended to be permanently sustained. The belief that it is possible to make money by slashing one's prices, driving everyone out, and then jacking them up is yet once again an expression of the mentality that wealth does not have to be produced, that it somehow just gets here, while businessmen are allegedly doing everything in their power to prevent it from being produced. Any firm which tried to follow such a policy would simply be playing the role of a fool. For every dollar by which it cut its price in order to inflict losses on its competitors would cause it itself either to suffer losses or to forego profits that would be a multiple of the losses it inflicted, in direct proportion to its larger size. If, for example, it were 10 times larger than its combined competitors, then every dollar by which it reduced its price would take $10 away from its own revenues and profits for every $1 it took away from the revenues and profits of its competitors. If such a firm should succeed in once driving its competitors out, and then attempt to raise its price to or above the initial level, it would immediately have new competitors, and again be confronted with the necessity of itself suffering losses or foregoing profits many times greater than the losses it could inflict on the new competitors. Such a policy leads nowhere but to losses or to foregone profits. The only circumstance in which it pays a firm to drive all of its competitors from the field is one in which two conditions are fulfilled. One, its cost of production is significantly lower than theirs. And two, the market for the product is of a kind that will sharply expand at a lower price, and thus will afford greater profits at the lower price than at the higher price. And in this case, the lower price is permanent. But even in this case, becoming the sole producer would not pay if the firm's cost advantages are of a kind that can be patented and thus shared with other producers in exchange for royalty payments. For then the firm could make additional profits on 100% of an expanded market without having to accumulate by itself all the capital required to supply the market. If either of these conditions, significantly lower costs and a sharply expandable market, is not present, then the only logical policy for a firm to pursue is simply to seek the largest possible share of the market at a price determined by a consideration of the product's cost of production. In a free market, it is impossible for anyone to charge prices higher than would be required for a potential new entrant into the industry to make a competitive rate of profit, except in the case of temporary scarcity and except to the extent that one's product may be at premium quality over his. If one does charge a price above this point, the outsider enters, and one cannot then reverse field and resort to the policy of driving him out by means of ruinous prices. One simply loses volume and must accept the lower price he will charge. The upper limit to one's price, therefore, is set by the cost of production of potential new entrants. If one goes higher than their cost plus an allowance for the competitive rate of profit they would require, one loses more and more volume until one is finally driven out oneself or accepts the fact that one cannot exceed this limit in price. One's price may certainly be lower than this limit, and will be whenever it is more profitable to charge a lower price, but it cannot be higher. The costs of potential new entrants constitute an objective given that limits one's price. One's only choice is to sell either a smaller volume at that cost-limited price, or a larger volume at that cost-limited price, or a still larger volume at a lower price, but one cannot get a higher price. Cost of production, as a direct determinant of prices, is something contemporary economic theory cannot comprehend, because, in its view, businessmen live only in the so-called short run, seeking to maximize profits from instant to instant. But if one wants the clearest possible demonstration of the direct influence of cost of production on price, one need only consider the case of table salt. That is a good for which every buyer would be willing, if he had to pay an enormously higher price. But what the buyers are willing to pay for table salt is totally irrelevant. Its price is set within the much lower limit determined by the cost of production, plus competitive profit of potential new producers. And were there only one seller of table salt, rather than the comparatively small number that presently exists, its price would be determined no differently. What stops any of the present sellers of table salt from raising his price is ultimately not the fear that the other sellers will not match his increase, but the fear of new entrants into the salt business. If the salt industry were legally closed to new entrants, then it would be to the interest of all the present producers to raise their prices. Each would gain much more by higher prices on the same volume than by the same price on any larger volume he might acquire at another producer's expense. This fear of new entrants, however, would be equally operative in a salt industry consisting of one firm as it is in the present salt industry consisting of perhaps half a dozen or a dozen firms. Legal freedom of entry is the essential foundation of competitive price determination. It provides the threat of new entrants whose costs determine the upper limit to every industry's prices. Contemporary economic theory has totally perverted the meaning and the significance of freedom of entry. It equivocates between freedom of entry and ability to enter. According to it, the fact that tailors are unable to enter the steel business is a violation of their freedom of entry. And the fact that steel is produced by means of multi-million dollar investments in the most modern blast furnaces and rolling mills instead of in backyard barbecue pits is a cause of higher steel prices. To the contemporary economist, a large capital requirement is a, quote, barrier to entry, unquote, indistinguishable from a policeman's gun or club. And barriers to entry is the cue which makes him respond with the words monopoly, inefficiency, and high prices. A large capital requirement is a barrier to entry, to the entry of inefficient producers, but it is only a barrier to the extent that it results in lower prices to the buyers than the less efficient producers could charge. If the more efficient producers did not charge lower prices, their large capitals would not be a barrier to entry. The higher the prices charged by the more efficient producers, the higher would be the allowable costs of their competitors. The higher the allowable costs of their competitors, the less complex and advanced the machinery their competitors would require. Hence, the smaller the capitals their competitors would need. The price of steel, however, or of any good produced with a large investment, is not set with regard to the cost that tailors would have with their insignificant capitals. The price of steel is set with regard to the cost that firms like General Motors or Ford or Alcoa would have were they to enter the steel business, with the magnitude of capital they could invest. The price of automobiles is set with regard to the cost that firms like International Harvester or Mack Truck or Boeing Aircraft would have were they to enter the automobile business with the magnitude of capital they could invest, and similarly for all other goods. Now, when a firm is in the position of having both sharply lower costs than anyone else and is confronted with a market that will greatly expand at a lower price, it can find it to its interest to charge a price which eventually eliminates all of its competitors, and thus it will become the only producer in its industry, for no one else will be able to remain in or choose to enter its field so long as this condition exists. Within its field, because of the comparative inefficiency of others, there ceases to be any competition. The firm in question becomes the undisputed champion without rivals. Such a firm, however, is not a monopoly. It was and continues to be an outstanding competitor. Indeed, it is a greater competitor as the sole producer in its industry than it was when it had rivals within its industry. For now it carries on the entire competition of its industry against all other industries, and does it more effectively. If, for example, the Alcoa Company or the Owens Corning Fiberglass Company were free, it is quite possible that they would find it to their interests to drop their prices, expand their production, and eventually drive their rival aluminum and fiberglass producers from the field. They would then represent the entire and a much more potent competition of the aluminum and fiberglass industries against the steel and lumber industries and against each other. The number of producers of a product, one, two, several, or many, is a totally insignificant matter, and no valid concept can be formed on the basis of it. On the one hand, it is impossible to use this criterion as the basis of any fundamental conceptual differentiation. On the other hand, it is impossible to use it to make any valid conceptual integration. The number of producers does not provide a basis for differentiating between competition and non-competition. An industry can give more competition to other industries when it has one producer rather than several or many, as we have just seen. Within an industry, more competition can exist with two or several large firms than with many small firms. For example, a merged Bethlehem-Youngstown steel concern would give stronger competition to the other steel firms than Bethlehem and Youngstown do separately. Indeed, whatever represents more potent individual value-seeking always represents more potent competition. Whoever can succeed in earning a larger revenue is, by that very fact, a more potent competitor, for he thereby excludes all others from a greater value. Thus, the General Motors Corporation is the greatest of all competitors in the economic system. It excludes all others from many billions of dollars of revenue. A sharecropper growing a few acres of wheat is the least of all competitors in the economic system. He excludes all others only from the earning of a few hundred or a few thousand dollars of revenue. The number of producers in an industry provides a basis of conceptual integration comparable to what would be provided if one formed a concept ripper that would embrace everyone who cut another person with a knife, surgeons and psychopaths alike. If a monopoly means the existence of just one seller in an industry, then the same concept is used to embrace a seller who maintains his sole position by means of his superior efficiency and a seller favored by officials, who maintains his sole position by means of the government's threat to imprison anyone who attempts to break it. And if the opposite of monopoly is supposed to be two or more firms in the same industry, then the opposite of an industry controlled by one favorite of the government is an industry controlled by two or more such favorites. To use an illustration based on the characters in Atlas Shrugged, if a monopoly means simply one producer in an industry, then the same concept covers Hank Reardon if he keeps Orrin Boyle out by means of his efficiency, and Orrin Boyle if he keeps Reardon out by means of Cuffy Mying's gun. And if the opposite of monopoly is simply two or more firms in the same industry, then the opposite of Boyle being the sole steel producer by means of Mying's gun is a steel industry in which Mying's competitive gun is used to maintain Boyle as one producer and Ivy Starnes as a second, with Reardon either not allowed to produce at all or not allowed to expand his production. It is, of course, not necessary to say that a steel industry comprised of 10,000 Mr. Moens and maintained by Mying's purely and perfectly competitive gun would also be no different. The criterion in terms of which a valid concept of monopoly must be defined is initiated government force. A monopoly is a market reserved to the exclusive possession of one or more sellers by means of initiated government force. The market may be that of a nation or part of a nation, that of an industry or part of an industry. The sellers to whom it is reserved may be one, two, several, or many. The sellers may always be the same or they may be changing. The essence of monopoly is that one or more potential sellers are denied access to a market by means of initiated government force. The market is made the exclusive possession of others by means of the government's aggressive use of its police power. The following are some examples of monopoly. 1. A protective tariff. Such a tariff reserves the market of a country to the exclusive possession of domestic producers. 2. Government franchises and licensing laws. Such controls reserve a market to the exclusive possession of those who have been favored with a franchise or who have met the licensing requirements. 3. Government-owned or government-subsidized enterprises. Such enterprises cannot be driven out of existence, for their losses are covered by the Treasury, and thus a market is reserved for their exclusive possession. 4. Antitrust laws. Such laws reserve markets to the exclusive possession of all but those who in a state of freedom would occupy them. They prevent the capable newcomer from entering an industry. For example, they would certainly operate to prevent General Motors from entering the steel industry in any significant way. They prevent the capable firms within an industry from acquiring the markets of the less capable ones by absorbing them in mergers, by buying them out, or by driving them out. They are far and away the greatest support of monopoly and obstacle to individual value-seeking, and thus to free competition, that any free country has ever had to endure. 5. A socialist government. Such a government represents monopoly carried to its ultimate limits. It reserves the entire market of its country to its own exclusive possession, with concentration camps, torture chambers, and firing squads to guarantee that reservation. Monopoly is a concept which simply does not apply to capitalism. It applies only to anti-capitalism. I must turn now to the theory of so-called pure and perfect competition, for it is a doctrine to which all of you who have had the misfortune of taking a college course in economics have been heavily exposed. Competition, as we have seen, is a derivative of individual value-seeking, which means of selfishness. It rests upon and presupposes the concept of selfishness. The theory of pure and perfect competition, however, is the economic expression of the altruist morality. No one has ever defined pure and perfect competition. The procedure is to present a list of conditions, the existence of which would describe it. These conditions are the conditions that would be required for the determination of prices to take place in accordance with the moral precepts of altruism. In precisely what manner this is so, we shall see presently. Altruism, however, is contrary to the facts of reality, and thus the economic conditions that would make pricing take place in accordance with its precepts simply do not exist, least of all under capitalism. Having arbitrarily called those conditions competition, however, contemporary economists then go on to denounce reality and capitalism for the absence of competition. They see everywhere varying degrees of departure from competition, and the presence of some element of what they call monopoly. These alleged elements of monopoly, however, turn out to be precisely the attributes of real competition, such as patents, copyrights, trademarks, brand names, advertising, mergers, tie-in sales, market-sharing agreements, and so on, all of which are means or methods of individual value-seeking, and thus of competition. The doctrine turns out to be a classic example of the stolen concept. It seizes and twists the derivative, competition, to attack its foundation, individual value-seeking. I quote Professor Claire Wilcox, a violent opponent of capitalism and a typical supporter of the theory of pure and perfect competition. The quotation is from Managerial Economics by Joel Dean, published by Prentice Hall in 1951. The specific passage comes from page 49 and the following page. Professor Wilcox has just given a page-long description of what he calls perfect competition, and which he chooses to characterize as a definition. He writes, quote, perfect competition, thus defined, probably does not exist, never has existed, and never can exist. Actual competition always departs, to a greater or lesser degree, from the ideal of perfection. Perfect competition is thus a mere concept, a standard by which to measure the varying degrees of imperfection that characterize the actual markets in which goods are bought and sold. End quote. This concept divorced from reality, ladies and gentlemen, this ideal of perfection drawn from non-existence for the purpose of damning existence, is the reason why businessmen have been imprisoned, major corporations broken up, and others prevented from expanding, your material well-being seriously curtailed, and why almost all businessmen are forced today to operate under conditions approaching the reign of terror, in which tens and hundreds of millions of dollars and the security of their own persons are at the mercy of the random whims of government officials and stray, existence-hating professors. The link between altruism and the doctrine of pure and perfect competition is a concept of property and a concept of price. No property is believed to be really private. At most, it is supposedly held in trusteeship for its alleged true owner, the community, or the consumers. The community, it is alleged, has a right to the property of every producer and suffers him to continue as owner only so long as it derives what it or its professorial spokesman consider to be the maximum possible benefit from its use. From this concept of property follows the contemporary economist's concept of price. A price is viewed not as the seller's reward, but as a means of rationing his products among those members of the community, or sovereign consumers, who happen to desire them. The justification of prices is held to be that they are a superior means of rationing than the issuance of coupons and priorities by the government. What the community allegedly has a right to is 100% of the seller's inventory and the benefit of 100% use of his plant and equipment. The exercise of this alleged right is to be limited only by consideration of the community's alleged interests. Thus, for example, a seller should produce at less than 100% of capacity only if the community's labor, materials, and fuel are held to be more urgently needed in another line of production, as demonstrated, supposedly, by their cost, the so-called marginal cost, exceeding the price of the product. All prices on this view should be scarcity prices, that is to say, prices determined by supply and demand. Supply, in the context of this doctrine, means the goods that are here, in the possession of sellers, and the goods or services that sellers are capable of providing with their existing plant and equipment. Demand means the set of quantities of the goods or services buyers will take at varying prices. Every price is supposed to be determined at whatever point is required to give the buyers the full supply in this sense. The essence of this theory of prices is the idea that every seller's goods and the unit services of his plant and equipment belong to the community and should be free of charge to the community's members unless and until price is required to ration them among the excessive demands of the cannibals contending for them. Prior to that point, they are held to be free goods, like air and sunlight, and any value they do have prior to that point is held to be the result of artificial, monopolistic restriction of supply. This is the answer modern economics gives to the Marxian theory of value. Take your pick as to which is worse. Consider the following example. A company, we'll assume, is able to produce up to 1 million units of its product at the same unit operating cost for labor, fuel, and materials. The ability to produce 1 million units of product with its existing plant and equipment, and at the same operating cost per unit, represents 1 million service units of plant and equipment of the same quality. According to the rationing theory of prices, the price of the company's product should contain no allowance for the value of its plant and equipment until at least 1 million units of product are being produced and sold. At that point, a service unit of plant and equipment can supposedly acquire an imputed scarcity value in the price of the product. Prior to that point, a service unit of plant and equipment is held to be either valueless or only to have a value as the result of an artificial, monopolistic restriction of supply, in quotes. If, let us say, Only 800,000 units of product are being produced and sold. Then, the supporters of the theory argue, the quantity of service units of plant and equipment implicitly demanded is only 800,000, while the supply is 1 million. If the imputed allowance for a service unit of plant and equipment in the product price is not already zero, then production should be expanded, reducing the product price until either all 1 million service units of plant and equipment are pressed into use, or until the imputed allowance for such a service unit in the product price does fall to zero. If, however, production remains at 800,000 units and the product price continues to allow a value for a service unit of the plant and equipment, then the value is supposed to be the result of the, quote, monopolistic withholding, unquote, of 200,000 service units of the plant and equipment from the market. The rationing theory of prices is never fully concretized. If it were, it could not be held. And so the illustration of it I will give will not be of a kind used by its supporters. The purpose of my illustration will be to show the connection between it and the collectivist view of property on the one side, and the pure and perfect competition doctrine on the other, and largely by mere concretization to demonstrate the manifest absurdity both of it and the doctrine of pure and perfect competition. To assure you that I am not inventing any of the conditions of pure and perfect competition, I quote Professor Wilcox's alleged definition. Please bear with me. Quote, the requirements of perfect competition are five. First, the commodity dealt in must be supplied in quantity, and each unit must be so like every other unit that buyers can shift quickly from one seller to another in order to obtain the advantage of a lower price. Second, the market in which the commodity is bought and sold must be well organized, trading must be continuous, and traders must be so well informed that every unit sold at the same time will sell at the same price. Third, sellers must be numerous. Each seller must be small, and the quantity supplied by any one of them must be so insignificant a part of the total supply that no increase or decrease in his output can appreciably affect the market price. Under these circumstances, the seller who sets his price above the market level will sell nothing, and the seller who sets his price below this level would get all of the business, were it not for the fact that he lacks the capacity to handle it. No seller will be able to get more than the market price. No seller will need to take less, since he can sell at the prevailing figure whatever quantity he is equipped to produce. Each seller will therefore take the market price as given and adjust his output to it, carrying production up to the point where the cost of producing an additional unit will equal the income that can be derived from its sale. Similarly, since no buyer will be able to obtain a supply at a figure below the market price, and no buyer will need to pay more than the market price to obtain whatever quantity he desires, each buyer will take the price as given and adjust his purchases to it. Fourth, there must be no restraint upon the independence of any seller or buyer, either by custom, contract, collusion, the fear of reprisals by competitors, or the imposition of public control. Each one must be free to act in his own interest without regard for the interests of any of the others. Fifth, the market price, uniform at any instant of time, must be flexible over a period of time, constantly rising and falling in response to the changing conditions of supply and demand. There must be no friction to impede the movement of capital from industry to industry, from product to product, or from firm to firm. Investment must be speedily withdrawn from unsuccessful undertakings and transferred to those that promise a profit. There must be no barrier to entrance into the market. Access must be granted to all sellers and all buyers at home and abroad. Finally, there must be no obstacle to elimination from the market. Bankruptcy must be permitted to destroy those who lack the strength to survive. End quote. To summarize these conditions, they are uniform products offered by all the sellers in the same industry, perfect knowledge, quantitative insignificance of each seller, no fear of retaliation by competitors in response to one's actions, constant changes in price, and perfect ease of investment and disinvestment. Low capital requirements would follow from the condition that each seller be insignificant and from the condition that investment and disinvestment be frictionless, in quotes. Now, to understand the need for all of these conditions, simply imagine a movie theater with 500 seats. The picture is about to go on. The projectionist, the ushers, and the cashier are all in their places. The community has the alleged right to the occupancy of 500 seats. If they are not all occupied for this performance, no future satisfaction could be obtained by any storing up of the use of the seats for a future time. The seats, the theater, the film, the necessary workers are here. The community supposedly has them, and now it demands the full benefit from its alleged property. The only thing which the community can save by the film not being run is the electric current that will be required, and which might be made available elsewhere, or the coal that must be consumed in generating the current. The costs of the theater, the film, the workers are all sunk costs, water over the dam, as the textbooks say. And since bygones are bygones, the only thing which counts for the community now is the cost of the electric current. The price of the electric current is the immediate operating, or so-called marginal cost. The theater, according to the collectivist rationing theory, should charge an admission price which will guarantee the sale of 500 tickets for the performance. If droves of people are standing in line for admission, it should raise the price to whatever point is required so that only 500 of the people standing on line will be able to afford it. If all of the people on line have identical incomes, medical disabilities, and natures of equal sensitivity, such a price, supposedly, will mean that the 500 people who want to see the film most will see it. If they are unequal in these respects, that's already supposed to be an imperfection, as Professor Wilcox would say, in the justice of the market mechanism. If, however, there are few people standing in line, the theater should begin reducing its admission price. It must keep on reducing its admission price until it has attracted 500 customers. If an admission price of only 2 cents is required to get this many customers, then supposedly that's what should be charged, provided only that the revenue brought in at the box office covers the cost of the electric current. If the theater persists in charging its standard price of, say, $1, at which it sells less than 500 tickets, then according to the collectivist rationing doctrine, it's guilty of administering its price and of monopolistic restriction of supply. It's engaged in a process of price control in violation of the laws of supply and demand, and in creating an artificial scarcity of seats by monopolistically withholding a portion of its supply from the market in order to maintain a high price on those seats for which it does sell tickets. If the theater cannot sell 500 tickets even at 1 cent per ticket, then according to this theory, it must either open its doors for free or close down. In this case, a theater seat is, allegedly, a free good. It's no longer scarce in relation to the demand for it. And so, allegedly, there is no longer any need for a price because there's no longer any need to ration theater seats. If there are 100 people who want to see the movie and who are prepared to make it worth the theater owner's while, he perhaps should run the film, provided he sells the remaining 400 tickets at whatever price is required to unload them, including zero. This, however, would be another imperfection in the market mechanism, price discrimination. The ideal solution in such a case is supposed to be to have the government nationalize the theater, charge nothing, and subsidize the loss. In the course of adjusting its price to attract customers, the theater must, of course, not send anyone onto the street to tell people about the movie it is playing or the price it is charging. That would be another imperfection, advertising. Advertising, according to the theory, is a wasteful and vicious means of demand creation. It allegedly makes the consumers act differently than they really want to act. So, as the theater is reducing its price, it must be careful not to be too obvious about it. Simply changing the price in the cashier's window should be enough. However, it is a requirement of the doctrine that all potential customers of the theater possess perfect and instantaneous knowledge of its price changes and of the picture it is showing. It is another imperfection in the operation of the market mechanism if people about to enter other theaters, or riding in their automobiles, or making love, do not receive instantaneous communication of the price changes, so that they may speedily alter their plans, and presumably an imperfection if they have not already seen each of the movies many, many times, to be perfectly informed about them. Because the theater owner wants to maximize his profits, he will not act in accordance with the theory's altruistic precepts, not in reality. However, he would, it is argued, if knowledge were perfect and automatic, if people did race back and forth between theaters in response to penny price differences, and if a number of further conditions were also realized. If, for example, there were 401 identical theaters in the same neighborhood, all showing precisely the same movie, and all in the same position with regard to empty seats, then, it is argued, the cunningly clever, profit-maximizing businessman would reason as follows. At my standard price of $1, I can only sell 100 tickets today. But if I charge 99 cents, or if we had an infinitely divisible currency, 99.999...9 cents, I can sell all 500 tickets. For in response to this insignificant price change, that is infinitely close to my present price, I could attract away one customer from each of the 400 other theaters. This would be very good for me, and none of the other theater owners would really notice the loss of just one customer, and thus no one would match my lower price. So that is what I will do. The same thought, however, will, it is assumed, simultaneously be racing through the heads of the other 400 theater owners, and so everyone's price will be trimmed just so much, and no one will end up with any additional customers drawn from other theaters. Each theater may attract 1% of an additional customer, who otherwise would not have gone to the movies, but that's all. At the infinitesimally lower price, the same process is repeated, as each theater owner seeks to maximize his profit, led by the idea that his insignificant price change will draw an unnoticed amount of business from each of many competitors, who will not reduce their prices in response to his action. The process of infinitely small price reductions is supposedly performed with infinite rapidity, and so instantaneously the price is brought down to the point where it's either just sufficient to cover the cost of the electric current, or everyone's theater is jammed to capacity. The importance of the large number of sellers in the theory of pure and perfect competition is that this is the main condition required to make self-interest result in self-sacrifice. If the individual seller were a significant part of the market and were in a position to handle a major part of the business done by his competitors, then, supposedly, he would never cut his price because he would know that as a result of his action, others will lose so much business that they will have to match his cut and that he will thus be left, basically, only with a lower price. With a large number of small sellers, every price cut is also matched. But, the argument is, not because of one's own price reduction, but because the other sellers are led to cut price independently, guided by the exact same thought that guides oneself. The significance of each seller having an identical product is supposed to be the greater responsiveness of customers to price changes. If each theater is playing a distinctive movie, customers are not likely to shift their business among them in response to infinitesimal price differences, and so a theater owner will have less incentive to trim his price. The significance attached to perfect knowledge is similar. This portrait of the economic world of perfection is not yet complete, however. There remains one other major requirement. It must be possible, as Professor Wilcox puts it, for investment to be speedily withdrawn from unsuccessful undertakings and transferred to those that promise a profit. There must be no barrier to entrance into the market. This condition would be achieved if movies were shown in tents, with projectors using candlelight instead of electricity. Then, whenever demand changed, theater owners would only have to unfold or fold up their theaters and light or blow out their candles. That would be perfection in full purity. The insanity of this doctrine is so great that any brief, thorough critique of it is impossible. The identification of its moral foundations and its mere concretization will have to suffice, but for the following observations. The essential complaint that is being made against business is that it does not submit to rapacious cannibalization, that it does not recognize a duty to produce or sell to capacity when it would mean taking a loss. Note, the argument is not that business is making excessive profits by any kind of monopoly, but that it is being monopolistic in refusing to suffer losses. Secondly, the doctrine is not even remotely aware of the existence of competition, or what that term means, or of the nature of self-interest. Every competitor who cuts his price is fully aware of the impact it will have on other competitors, and that they will match his cut. He acts in the knowledge that some of them will not be able to afford the cut, while he can, and that he will eventually pick up their business, or that he will gain most of the new customers for the product, because his competitors do not have the capacity for expansion that he has. Or he may cut the price simply in order to keep newcomers from the field. He does not live in a rat's world, hoping to scurry away unnoticed with an insignificant piece of others' cheese, only to find that all the other rats have been guided by the same stupidity, with the result that all have less cheese. Even very small, comparatively insignificant competitors, in the kind of situation the pure and perfect competition theory postulates, idle capacity, do not behave as it believes. In depressions, barbers, tailors, and grocers do not blindly cut their prices. All the significant price cutting that occurs, occurs in the rational belief by some of the sellers that they will be better off at the lower price that they know everyone will have to charge. To continue this same point of criticism, contrary to the doctrine of pure and perfect competition, price competition is an omnipresent phenomenon of our economic system. It was price competition that drove Studebaker from the automobile business, and that keeps other firms out of the automobile business. If the prices of the major auto producers had been significantly higher, Studebaker could have made profits and others could have entered. Price competition is given by whoever charges a price that excludes others from the market or any part of the market. It has nothing to do with the kind of pricing envisioned by the pure and perfect competition doctrine. Thirdly, if by some incredible miraculous means prices were determined in accordance with the moral precepts of altruism, the catastrophe would be incalculable. With the slightest change in demand, prices could plummet or skyrocket. Imagine you would walk into a restaurant for dinner, only the restaurant wouldn't give you a menu. They'd seat you in front of a ticker tape, and you'd have to buy a futures contract on dessert. Since no prices would be sticky in such a world, but all of them constantly changing, you wouldn't know as you walked back to your apartment whether you could afford to live there that night, or whether perhaps the rentals of penthouses had collapsed. Since producers would suffer major losses on their investments whenever demand fell to a point that might require them to work below capacity, for as theaters would often barely cover the cost of current, railroad trains would often barely cover the cost of fuel, and steel mills would often barely cover the costs of labor and ore, they'd be sure to own only the most minimal capacity. That way, when one more customer came to board a train or to buy steel, he'd be confronted with the alternative of riding in the luggage rack or melting down his doorknobs, or else driving the price up. The doctrine of pure and perfect competition is an utter disgrace to economics. It is the product of the cowardly attempt to defend capitalism against Marxism on the grounds of altruism. It has been developed and maintained in the most blatant disregard of reality by out-of-focus authors lost in a world of curves and equations. The rebirth of economics will occur when this gross monstrosity and its twin brother, the Keynesian system, are torn from the subject root and branch. Until that time, economics, as it is taught at the universities, will remain a nonsense subject, of the same value and with the same relevance to reality as the medieval disputes concerning the number of angels that could dance on the head of a pin. The rebirth of economics and of capitalism, however, are both in sight. Only 15 years ago, it would have been possible to assemble the articulate advocates of capitalism and the real economists into one not too large living room. Since that time, capitalism and economics have been taken out of the living room and brought to the notice of a large and growing public, thanks mainly to Ayn Rand and Atlas Shrugged. Today I am convinced there are more articulate spokesmen for laissez-faire and more people with a real knowledge of economics in the United States than at any time since almost before the Civil War. 15 years from now, I believe, barring an atomic war, economics, capitalism, objectivism, will be a major cultural force in this country. The standard has been raised. The wise and honest are repairing to it, and the future will be ours. I thank you.